I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We are going to have a conversation this hour with Laura Lippman. Her latest book is I'd Know You Anywhere, and I can't count the number of times Laura's been on this program, but it's been many over the last 17 years, and for each one of her books. And back again, Laura, welcome. Good to see you.
Thanks. It's always good to be here talking to you.
It's always great. This is very different. This is a very different book for you, I think
it is in some ways. I mean, it is a crime story. It's the story about a long ago crime and the ramifications it has for its victim many years past. It involves nothing of police procedure investigation. There's no real mystery about what happened. A 15-year-old girl named Elizabeth was kidnapped and raped by a man whom she had stumbled upon while he is burying another girl's body. The man is named Walter Bowman. He has killed at least two girls that he sexually assaulted. It's believed that he probably killed many others, but he never confessed. He wasn't caught for those crimes. And he does not kill Elizabeth, although he kills another girl essentially in front of her. And that's in her past. It's now almost 25 years hence, just shy of that. And he writes her from death row, asking if he can speak to her before he's put to death. And, I mean, that's chapter one, basically. You know, that setup, I'm not giving anything away. And in a way, I don't think I'm giving anything away when, you know, I say, of course she's going to have some sort of contact with him. But there is a very long and tortured process toward that, where she has to decide what she really wants, what she risks by talking to him, what she risks by not talking to him. So it's really psychological. It's mainly inside her head. But, you know, for me, it was, okay, this is what I do. I write about crime. This is a crime. But now I want to write about it from the point of view of what's it like to be, in quotes, the lucky one. Again, in quotes, the one who was only raped. And it was very important to me to write about a crime victim who, all things considered, is incredibly healthy and together, who has found a way to live in this world and not be a mess all the time, although these memories are always at the edge of her consciousness and can have great power over her.
One of the things that struck me about the way you approach this book is it's the way you look, and I'm going to go through some of these characters. We won't give anything away about what's happening in the book. I would never do that, but just to play with some of these ideas. It's the way you look at and develop these characters, who they become, and you do it in this amazing non-judgmental way. There's like no value judgment on these people, it seems.
I try. I mean, of course, that's trickiest when writing from the point of view of Walter Bowman, who's a terrible person.
Yes.
Probably would come away with a clinical diagnosis of being a sociopath. But that's not who Walter is inside his head. Who is he inside his head? He's in his head. He believes he is a man who has very normal desires and yearnings, that he deserves more than he's getting in life, that he's being thwarted by things that are out of his control. And it's just never his fault what he does, you know, because in his head, he's a man who's asking for the most basic things. He wants companionship and love. You know, he's got a job, or he has a job, at least when we first meet him. He is, to his way of thinking, he's fairly presentable. He's fairly good looking, although as it becomes clear over the course of the book, on first impression, Walter is good looking. On second impression, there's probably something a little bit creepy there, which is why he can't find a woman of his own age. So that was, I mean, it's interesting for me as a writer. One of the things I figured out over the course of doing this for a long time is that the characters I'm probably most likely to make fun of are the characters who are sometimes most like myself. I feel freer. And so you have this character, Barbara, who is an advocate for men on death row.
Right.
And she can be rather maddening and silly and almost selfish in her selflessness. She's so convinced of her correctness, of her goodness, that she can just be the worst person in the world. And the thing is that politically, I'm aligned with Barbara. I'm against the death penalty. And yet I felt very free to write her as a character who is, as I just described. And then you have a character such as the mother of one of the dead girls, who is almost wild with her desire to see Walter put to death.
Trudy. Right.
And I don't agree with her politically at all. But I found that I really opened myself up to her and said, okay, I'm going to have complete empathy for this person who's nothing like me. As I got to the end of the book, one of the things I had to confront for myself, this book is not a polemic. It doesn't take a political stand on the death penalty at all. And I remain staunchly opposed to it. But as I got to the end of the book, I thought to myself, I really hope and truly pray, literally pray, that I am lucky enough to be able to only consider the death penalty in a theoretical light, because I'm not sure how I would feel if it had application in my life. And I might feel as Trudy does. I'm not sure I would say that openly. I'm not sure that I would lobby for my point of view.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if someone killed someone close to me, yeah, I'd probably want them dead.
You said a few things here. I just want to spend a few minutes exploring. Let's start with the last thing you said, and then I'll come back to this Barbara and Trudy, because those two characters that really hit me in very unusual ways as I read the book. Hit both of us as we read the book in very unusual ways. But, you know, when you were describing how you built Barbara, the woman who's a advocate of death penalty and trying to save Walter's life, I always found over the years at times that and that when you have somebody in a room who you agree with politically more than you don't,
mm-hmm.
that you can be harder on them than you are
absolutely
on the ones that you disagree
with.
That's what I thought about reading that character.
I agree. And I think Barbara's a lot like me. There's some other things going on in Barbara. Barbara is a person who is not worried about her material comfort. She herself is the victim of a violent crime, received a large settlement, and she lives comfortably. She, to the extent that we know anything about her private life, which we don't know much, but she goes to the theater, she enjoys, you know, food, she goes to yoga class. I mean, she's not that unlike me. And, you know, again, I think that there's always this danger. I'm really aware of it in myself that, you know, the lack of grit in one's life, the lack of things sort of pushing back at you, not being in regular contact with people who disagree with you, not worrying about how you're going to pay your utility bill.
Uh-huh.
Those things, if you're not careful, can lead to this dangerous self-satisfaction and smugness.
Absolutely.
And so I was kind of writing sort of out of that understanding of my own character, which is I feel I have to sort of be on guard not to become incredibly self-satisfied. And, you know, Trudy, at the same time, is also a person who doesn't worry about material comfort. I mean, it's interesting. I'm only coming to this right now talking about the book. This is a book about people who are largely held harmless from the current economic situation.
Mm-hmm.
Elizabeth, who now goes by the name of Eliza, is the only person who consciously thinks about that. And she thinks about her husband used to work at newspapers. He's made a very successful transition into the financial world. They're doing better than they've ever done. They are not in the crisis that has embroiled so many people right now. And she thinks about that. And she thinks about what is it like to be that lucky. She's constantly thinking about the responsibilities inherent in good fortune. And I think her husband at one point has said to her, in terms of having been someone who left the newspaper industry, you know, right before it just craters out, that he's like, I feel like I went on my lunch break and I came back and the building was on fire. Well, certainly I feel that way about the newspaper industry. I left in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
If you had talked to me 3 years ago, I probably would have still been very bullish on the future of newspapers. So they'll be fine. They'll always be newspapers. We'll always need them. So again, these are things that I am drawing from my personal life. I know what it's like to be lucky, and I know what it's like to worry about that you'll forget that you're lucky and become kind of calloused and think that, oh, well, it's not that you were lucky, it's that you were just so smart and you planned your life so well. I think that's the most dangerous thing anyone can think.
Because a lot of it, and you say this in the book, this life in itself, a lot of it is the luck. It's what happens to you. It's how you wake up. It's what you stumble into. And
right.
Then build from what you stumble into, what you stumble into.
Right. And it's a terrifying notion. It's one that most of us aren't at all prepared to confront. I think it's easier to confront in fiction than it is in media, in newspapers and magazines.
I never thought about it until this moment either, that all these, the majority of characters in this book, all of them except for Walter, are economically comfortable.
Right. When I first started working on the book, it was actually part of the early planning stages. I thought I was going to put the Benedict family through a financial crisis. You know, I think my first vision of the book was that Walter Bowman reaches out from death row to his only living victim, and her life begins to fall apart. And, you know, she has a daughter who's acting up. She's a teenage daughter who's clearly up to something. She's become petulant and angry and rebellious like many adolescents do.
She's 13.
Yeah. And, you know, her husband is, you know, I thought, well, maybe then her husband would have some. And then I started thinking about it. I was like, you know, that just isn't what interests me right now. As if anything, it seems to me that that's what is expected. And then people, I think furthermore, would have expected in a situation like this for there to be much more tension between husband and wife. Eliza is married to a man who is remarkably unthreatened by what's going on. His only concern is that she do what's right for her, and he doesn't pretend to guess at what
that
is.
He's a pretty nice guy.
He's a really,
really nice
guy. And as I began working on the book, I thought, you know what? I think this is more unexpected than tension and conflict arising from the situation. And I really started thinking about this character I created who, in a lot of ways, she's ordinary, which is, I mean, she's someone you wouldn't think about twice if she was in your life. You think, oh
Eliza.
Eliza. Yes.
Right, right.
What a nice lady. Lovely kids. I saw her at PTA. She is a genius at her own survival. This is part of the reason she's alive, is because she did somehow stumble on the right things to do that kept her alive. And she's been really smart about her own recovery with the help of her parents. And I thought, you know what? She married the right guy. She made a really good choice. He's one of the few people in the world outside of her family who even knows what happened to her. And I thought she made a good choice. And in this crisis, that choice should be rewarded. And you should see that she was so smart to pick Peter as her husband, because he is protective, but not overly protective. There's a section of the book I really like is when Peter announces that the family needs a dog.
That's a curious piece.
And he's
piece.
Always been opposed to it on many levels. And all of a sudden, he's like, we need a dog. And Eliza immediately figures out, which is that he's a little bit worried. So he wants her to have this protection. He's not going to tell her what kind of dog. You know, it's just sort of his way of doing it. Is to
maybe
say,
a German Shepherd, maybe a black lab.
Yeah, you know, just, you know, he's advocating for a big dog. None of those little dogs, but she sees it immediately. She understands it. She loves him for it. She doesn't resent it. I mean, that's a pretty caring thing to do. I mean, he's sort of trying to find his comfort zone too, which is, I love you. I'm nervous for you. I mean, to be clear, one of the things that I think when I was working in the early stages of the book and talking to my editor about it, she said, well, you know, wouldn't this make her feel fearful for her family's safety? I was like, you know what? She's a pretty pragmatic person. She understands that Walter Bowman is not going to be able to escape death row in Virginia and come to her house. Even if he could escape, that's not what he would do. This isn't about physical safety. It isn't about her thinking that he's going to come after her teenage daughter. It's about what his presence in her life forces her to confront about buried memories. And so, yeah, I mean, I like to think that I did some really counterintuitive things in this book.
I was prepared for on one or more occasions for Peter to kind of get his hackles up about something.
His foot down, yes, and say, yes, "Gosh darn it, you're not going to write that man a letter. You're not going to talk to him on the phone."
And I liked the relationship. I thought this is such a good. I felt so lucky for her and him both.
Yeah, they're a really good couple, and it's a really good family. I mean, this book is absolutely a hymn to quotidian life. You know, everything in this book that is sort of happy and presented as a highlight in Eliza's life is, you know, watching Brigadoon on television with her children, going out for soft ice cream, making cupcakes, taking a dog for a walk. I mean, it is very consciously about sort of these day-to-day joys that, you know, most of us do lose sight of. And in Eliza, at the end of the book, has to remind herself consciously never to lose those moments.
Now I won't. I'm not going to go to the end of the book, but I again coming back to this kind of humanistic view of your characters, this kind of non-judgmental view, and I'm thinking about. I was thinking about Trudy just a moment ago. Well, let me get to Trudy, then we come back to Walter. Trudy, who lost her daughter to this man who killed her. And it's not giving anything away to know that.
No.
I really felt for her. I didn't necessarily like her a lot. There's things about her that really bothered me, and what she did really, you know, that heck came into my house. What are you doing here? But the pain she felt at the loss of a child is something I think you tapped into that every parent fantasizes about, even though they don't want to talk about they fantasize about it. Every parent fantasizes about losing a kid like that.
My mother-in-law lost her only daughter to breast cancer 21 years ago. And she's missed her every day.
Yeah.
And I'm very aware of that. I'm very aware that, and I wasn't part of the family then. I've never known the sister-in-law that I lost, Linda. I'm a very gifted painter. Her canvases are all over our house. So, you know, I've long been aware that grief is different for everyone, mm-hmm. that people do have moments of forgetting, but there are certain griefs that just don't go away. And when we, sometimes, not always, but sometimes when we ask people to get over things, we're really asking for ourselves. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you love someone, you don't want them to be sad, and it makes you uncomfortable because they're sad and there's nothing you can do about it. But at the same time, I think you just have to recognize that there's some things people don't get over. You know, Trudy is a well-to-do woman. She's lived a life of comfort. She has sons. She has grandchildren. You know, I think some people from the outside looking in would be like, okay, well, yes, you lost your daughter in a particularly horrible way, but look at all you have. And she just has no patience with that point of view. She can't get over losing her daughter, and she believes that enacting the death penalty will provide something. She doesn't even know what it is, but just that she wants it. It's almost as if it would be an acknowledgement of how severe her pain is to inflict this punishment. And she's someone who hasn't quite gotten to that moment of realizing that she was an enormously lucky person and then bad luck happened to her. She kind of tiptoes around it. You know, she is someone who unfortunately fell into the trap of thinking that she had earned her good life, and now it's been taken from her, and that's so unfair. But, you know, someone else might argue, well, gee, you know, here you were born into a life of privilege and comfort. You know, your husband was an army surgeon, but, you know, was, you know, you have these other kids, these other grandkids, you're doing pretty well relative. You know, she can't see herself that way.
But it's the anger she shows towards certain people in the book that really was kind of that kind of anger to somebody who couldn't control what happened.
She wants there to be a scenario under which her daughter didn't die. She wants someone to blame. And the sad fact is she has fastened all of that anger on a 15-year-old girl who is just as helpless as her own daughter, and she can't see that. She wants to believe that the young Elizabeth, as she was known, she became known as Eliza after her kidnapping, could have saved her daughter's life. And in failing to do so, is almost as guilty as Walter is.
And this Walter, the way you created him, portrayed him, painted him, built him. I mean, there are a lot of men that I know who are in jail, who I knew from the old days. And when I worked in the joint, they're bad men, and just bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I know from them, I know the pain they went through in their lives that turned them into bad men. But nevertheless, they are bad men.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of what really got to me about this character, Walter. That it was the ability to kind of not make this guy empathetic, but to also understand him as a human being and how he saw himself.
Yeah, you could never make him empathetic, but I think the goal is to let readers see him as he sees himself. You know,
that's an important point, the way you just put it. Yeah.
Yeah. The average serial killer is not a genius IQ professor running around devising elaborate puzzles and word games for the investigators who chase after him. I mean, according to profilers, the average serial killer is of average or below average intelligence. And it's important to me to write toward that reality. I mean, I like the other kinds of books, too. I like books with diabolical geniuses, but I don't happen to write those. And I guess the thing for me that's sort of unresolved is there's a part of me that thinks that Walter isn't entirely wrong in one aspect in the way he views himself. Because I think Walter, if asked, would say that he could have been saved by the love of a good woman. You know, if he had just found
right.
that woman who would love him and understand what a prize he was, because that's very important to him. You know, he's got a job. He thinks he's handsome. He thinks he's intelligent. He thinks he has a lot to offer. And he's genuinely baffled. He doesn't see what women his age see in him, which
yes.
is a very dangerous, not quite right, maybe angry guy. And, you know, when I was thinking about this book, I'm not really interested in writing about pedophilia because I think it's a compulsion and there's just not much that's interesting to say about it. I think it's really sad, and I'm as baffled as anyone by what to do with pedophiles, because it's hard to help them. It's hard,
very hard
to rehab them. What I was interested in is sort of the opposite, which is this guy, and, you know, you're the father of daughters. You know about these guys. They go after much younger women who happen to look very womanly.
Mm-hmm.
They're not interested in little kids, far from it. They are interested in someone who physically meets their criteria for what a good-looking woman would be, but who doesn't have sort of the native intelligence to see how dangerous they are. And when they can't find it in their own age group, they dip down a little bit lower. You know, a lot of 15-year-old girls who get pregnant via much older men.
Absolutely. That's true.
It's just factual.
It is factual.
How is that happening?
And 30s, right.
I mean, really, why does a 25-year-old man want anything to do with a 15-year-old girl? And I just happen to believe it's because, well, he tried 24-year-olds. He just kept looking for a girl who was inexperienced enough to see him as he wanted to be seen. I mean, the fact is, Walter isn't even doing that well with 15-year-old girls. I mean, that's how off he is. I mean, he can get the conversation started.
Right.
But, you know, like even a couple of minutes into a conversation, Walter's victims are getting that he's not quite right. And they don't want anything to do with him. And that, of course, is what unleashes this horrible rage and lethal reaction in him.
And I think also with pedophiles not being able to be, that they don't appear to be able to be rehabilitated from everything I've studied, interviewed, questioned over the years in this area a lot. Despite sweet R. Berlin's, Dr. Berlin's efforts at Hopkins, but this too is that kind of sickness that happens to men who are older, and you're right about women. There's something in the face, in the movement, in the eyes, and that you can just look at him and know, you know,
the more
that,
life experience you have. Yeah,
you know, it's.
You know, one thing that's clearly going on in this book is I'm really fascinated by the mixed messages of pop culture, where, you know,
play with that a lot
between pop songs, and there's a passing reference to the soap opera General
right.
Hospital.
Right.
And I got to thinking about that, and it was in 1981 that General Hospital held what was the second biggest wedding of the summer, the biggest wedding being Charles and Diana, but second only to that was a soap opera wedding between two characters who were presented as being, you know, some of the great soulmates, the great lovers of all time, and he had raped her at one point. And I just started thinking about that one day, and I thought, okay, that's really screwed up.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, and I mean, I'm sure at the time people said that's really screwed up, and my memory is that some women's rights groups and groups that were dedicated to domestic violence causes brought that up at the time. But even so, there are all these little teenage girls back in 1981 who were being sent this message that when someone really, really wants you, when someone really, really yearns for you, ultimately you should be flattered by that. That yearning, that you know, even if it crosses over into kind of stalkerish obsession or violence, but if he really, really, really loves you, isn't that a wonderful thing if he really wants you? And it's disturbing. You know, there are pop songs that you listen to, and if you really take them apart, they're really creepy.
You maybe want to go hear these pop songs you talk about here. To revisit them, go up on the web and pull them down and go hear what you were listening to.
I have to admit that was actually some enjoyable research. I watched a lot of videos too. You can go over to MTV.com and go back to 1985 when the music video was a fairly new form
right.
then, and they were elaborate. They were amazing little mini movies. There's this one Phil Collins video that he does a Western. He does a samurai movie. He does, you know, a parody of David Lee Roth singing California. I mean, it was just like reference upon reference upon reference. I thought, wow, I'd forgotten all about
this. Is one of the songs that?
No, it isn't even one of the songs in the
I didn't know all these songs.
They were all, you know, the idea behind the songs, which are used as chapter headings and really never explained, is that back in the day, I don't know what it's going to be like going forward. We now have so much control over what we hear and what we listen to and what we watch when we watch it. But, you know, back in my day, you listen to the radio and you listen to the songs they played. And
right.
one of the things I had observed is that there are certain songs that are just, they're time machines. They will carry you back to a bygone era like that. The interesting thing about them is they don't tend to be songs that you like very much, because if you really like a song, you're like, I love Elvis Costello, so I've been listening to him steadily now for 30 years. So if I hear the song Allison, it doesn't adhere to one time in my life.
Right.
But if I hear a Hall & Oates song, because I have not kept the faith and gone forward listening to Hall & Oates, you know, I can tell you where I was when, you know, Your Kiss Is On My List was a pop song. You know, that brings back for me that time perfectly. And I was thinking, you know, for an average person, this is actually a fairly benign experience. But I just began to thinking about my character, Eliza, and how it was anything but benign, how these silly poppy songs that were on the radio in the summer of 1985, each one is like a minefield. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, you know, so, and they're all, you know, they're all songs that somehow seem to work on several levels.
I'm Mark Steiner. We're talking with Laura Lippman, her latest mystery novel, I'd Know You Anywhere. We'll be back in just a minute. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and we're talking with Laura Lippman about her latest work, I'd Know You Anywhere. The underlying things is that, the way you dealt with the death penalty in this book. I mean, you said what you think about the death penalty, but it's a very tough subject. It's something that I've, you know, again, one of those things that I've covered and interviewed. I remember interviewing Flint Gregory Hunt before he was executed. We were allowed to do that, and looking at this guy and saying, I think he really did change. I think there's a different human being than the man who made this heinous, who killed this young woman. But it's so wrought with so much. When you make it on a personal level and a political level, there are very different emotions that can come to the fore.
So the thing I decided for myself, I mean, I always knew I didn't want to write a book that was taking a political stand.
Was polemical about this.
And because of that, and the reason for that is because, having thought about it a lot, I know very few adults who change their mind about anything. You know, you reach your points of view however you reach them, and it's really unusual for people to change their minds. It's just, especially on these certain core issues. Mm-hmm. I mean, people don't change their mind that often on the death penalty and abortion, on pacifism. You know, and one of the interesting things about our culture is we have all these people yelling all the time, it seems, about their points of view, but they're yelling to the people who already agree with them. It's so odd to me that so many people choose to spend their time listening to people speak very heatedly about things they already agree with. I mean, that's not anti-conservative, pro-liberal. That's just across the spectrum, this idea that we need to listen to sort of outraged people saying what we think. And I'm not sure what to think about that. So I thought, I'm not going to change anyone's mind writing a book. And that was very freeing. Like, instantly mm-hmm. understanding that wasn't the point. I was fascinated with what I learned about the death penalty in Virginia. And the fact that, you know, you can't get a new trial based on new evidence more than 21 days after the ending of the original trial. I was interested to see, Virginia is second per capita after Texas in the number of people it has executed since the death penalty was reestablished. And it's fast. One of the biggest challenges in this book was that I needed enormous literary license to create a case in which someone was on Virginia's death row for over 20 years, because it's never happened. I think the longest I found was maybe 12 years. And I acknowledge him in the book. I talked to this amazing attorney down in Virginia who represents people on death row. One of his clients was John Muhammad, the Beltway sniper.
Mm-hmm.
And he was enormously helpful in giving me ideas that would allow me to create something that was at least credible. Probably wouldn't happen, but at least the story I created for Walter is credible. And he was very generous with his time. And one of the things he told me that really stuck with me is that he's never had a client who didn't feel remorse. And one of the people he represented, I remember reading about him and just thinking, boy, this is a guy who really tests my objections to the death penalty, and that would be tough. But, he said he had never had a client who didn't feel remorse. He was also amazingly helpful in terms of telling me about the sights and sounds of death row. Yeah, I couldn't get in there. And it was his observation that the death house in Virginia looks like the jail on the old Andy Griffith show, only with an execution chamber.
Right, that was a great line.
So that was totally his. I would never have known that. And that's, I don't overdo research. I'm not enamored of it. I'm writing fiction. I get to make stuff up. But one of the reasons to talk to people who do know things is because never in 1,000 years am I going to sit there in front of my laptop and come up with the idea that the death house looks like the Andy Griffith show. And so that's a case where what real life gives you is so much better than anything you can imagine. You just have to use it.
And with your books, they have been, and you want them to be, credible. You want the stories to be credible, the characters to be credible, what they go through to be credible, not so far over the edge that it couldn't have happened.
Right. And, of course, real life often does seem like it's so far over the edge. You can't imagine, it would never pass muster in a novel. But, yeah, I just, again, it was just once I figured out, okay, this novel isn't really about the death penalty. And I'm not trying to persuade anyone to think, and if anything, I'm going to have people who represent the triangle, which is we have someone who is adamantly for it. We have someone who's adamantly against it. And between them, we have Eliza, who
you assume is against it.
Theoretically, she is against it, her parents were against it and were challenged on that. What if it was your daughter? And her father even articulates the point of view that as a father, he would want to kill the man who killed his daughter. But he expects his government, his state, to hold him to a higher standard than that. That is not what he believes civilization is, and that his impulses should not be honored by the law. They should be understood, they should be empathized with, but they should not be codified into law, that's not how law is made. Again, there is this very conscious choice to surround the main character with terrific people. She has a great husband. She has really good parents.
Even her
older sister, who's kind of high-strung and melodramatic,
you get to she grows on you during the course of the
book. You see, she is a good sister. She's the best she can be. I mean, her kids, even though her daughter Iso is driving her crazy, she loves her very much. And, her son Albie is still, young enough to be loving and affectionate. And, he's a source of great comfort to her. Again, all very conscious. I wanted to show someone who had a lot to lose.
It was, and you did. And I think that what you said about the death penalty earlier, the death penalty, to me, is a character in the book. In a way, it's a character because it's the complexity of all the characters being built, and it's the complexity of the death penalty. It's again the non-judgmental view of where everything lives. I think is very kind of a very critical way. It's very different. I really. Really enjoyed that part of it, and also the people could look at this and go, "Oh, the Stockholm syndrome," which you deal with too in the book a bit. When it wasn't that's not Eliza. I mean, Eliza went through a struggle that seemed to me to be so typical of what a 15-year-old girl would go through, or a little kid would go through if they're taken by somebody else.
I mean, understanding someone else to the point of even being able to develop empathy for them does not blind one to their flaws and inadequacies and the places in which they're wrong. And the central question in this book is, there's no doubt Eliza understands Walter. Even as a 15-year-old, she sort of got him.
Mm-hmm.
And she's very careful. And in the scenes in the past, she's often shown thinking one thing and saying another. She's always weighing what to do to sort of keep him at his most benign. She's aware she's with a very dangerous person. And she's gauging what is it going to take to have him do the least amount of harm to her, which often means agreeing with things that he says that she finds ludicrous. But she doesn't challenge him. She's learned not to challenge him. She knows him. She gets him. She understands him better than anyone has ever understood him or ever will. But is there an obligation inherent in that? You know, one of the things I was really conscious of in writing this book, you know, no, most of us, you know, knock wood, will never be in a situation where we're the victim of someone like this, where we're held hostage, where, you know, we're assaulted. But most of us in our lives will be in relationships where, whether it's with a family member or a romantic relationship or a friend, where we'll absolutely get the other person. We will so understand them and understand why they do what they do. But does that mean we have to stick by them?
Right.
You know, just because you really, really understand someone, is that an obligation or a debt? And I don't think it is necessarily.
One of the beauties of this book is the mystery in this book revolves around all those issues you've just been raised, because you don't know where this book is going to take you in those mysteries or the issues you raise. It's not this typical, it's not a typical murder mystery from one of your old Tess Monahan stories, which is about a crime that's to be solved and you got to go figure out who did it and then the twists and turns. And this is really about the twists and turns of existence stuck in the middle of a crime that had been committed.
Mm-hmm.
And how things, not knowing where this is going to turn out, not knowing what's going to happen with Eliza and Walter, and it's a different kind of mystery, which is really kind of it's a fascinating way to kind of look at a story like this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are things that aren't quite clear about what happened, and there are all these different versions of it. Everything complicated, of course, by memory, because we're now talking about something that happened 23 years ago. I mean, who remembers what? Who knows?
Right.
But, you know, I don't think it gives anything away. I mean, clearly this is a book that from the first chapter is headed toward an encounter between Eliza and Walter. They must meet again. They must come face to face. And what I like to think is that no one knows what's going to happen when it does. Not even Eliza really knows what's going to happen when she finally breaks down and goes to confront Walter.
That's one of the things we talked about at the end of our drive this morning, coming back from the Jersey Shore, we both were saying, as Valerie read the last few pages to me aloud in the car coming back, neither one of us could figure out exactly what was going to happen in the end between Walter and Eliza. You just know which way, even in the midst of what you wrote later in the book, between them, you didn't know where that was going to take you, exactly where it was going to end up. And you had your gut feelings and you were yelling at sometimes the characters to do this. Come on. No.
Right. You know? Don't do that. No, do
no,
this.
No, no, no,
oh,
no.
Gosh, what are you thinking?
So that, you know, that so it was very well done.
Thank you.
Really well done. I have to ask you something that I've heard. Did I hear from other people who read something somewhere else that I didn't read that Tess Monahan is being made into a TV serial?
She's being pitched.
She's being pitched.
by some really good people. I mean, the writer attached to the project is Jay Cox, who wrote Gangs of New York.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Among other things, and she's being pitched as a television series. Right now, there's this enormous interest in television series built around strong women.
It's about time.
And Tess Monahan is nothing if not that.
That's right.
So that's being pitched. And, you know, I get, you know, bulletins from time to time about how it's going and what the strategy is. And I think I am about as nonchalant about film and television as any novelist I know.
We live with it every day.
Yeah, yeah. I've had a close-up view of what goes on in television, and I just really get that, look, it would be great if it happened. I'd be so happy if it happened, although not to get political here, but the sad fact is people say, and of course they'll film it in Baltimore. I said, I don't think they will because of the tax credit situation.
That's,
you know, there's no incentive to film in Baltimore. I mean, I feel bad about that. But
there's a Burroughs coming up to help raise money for that. We're actually going to do a show with those folks.
Excellent.
Push that.
You know, no, it's really sad what has happened to the Maryland film industry. I don't know if people realized just what an amazing group of talent there was here, and technical people, and
right.
The craft unions were really strong. So if there is a test right now, if there were to be a test television show, it couldn't film here for financial reasons.
Filmed in Toronto or something.
Or Connecticut. Detroit has all the money.
Right.
So, yeah, so they're shopping that around, and I would love to see it happen, but I just think, well, I'm in good hands. You know, these are good people.
Who was the actor that saw the book? Was it your agent lived in the same
book? No, that's a different book.
That's
Every
different
Secret
book?
Thing is the one that,
oh.
Now that is actually further along in the process. Fran McDormand optioned the book. She
Great
lives,
actor.
Amazing. She lives in the same apartment building as my literary agent in New York. They're friends.
Okay.
My agent gave Fran the book, and there's a script. It was written by Nicole Holofcener. It was recently announced that Diane Lane is attached to star in it.
Wow.
We have everything but money.
Minor details.
Yeah, minor details. I mean, there are just, you know, so many little absurd behind-the-scenes details of it was at this studio and blah, blah, blah. And it's all very uninteresting, I think. However, I think the world of Frances McDormand.
She optioned the book? Just
she optioned it. She's producing pretty actively, and she's got
really?
Great taste. She also has the option on Olive Kitteridge, which won the Pulitzer, and she optioned it before it won the Pulitzer, and she's taking that to HBO as a possible television
That's
series.
Great.
She's really smart.
That's very cool.
She strikes me as that kind of...
Yeah,
very well read, extremely well read, and she's. I had the great good fortune to go see her. Oh, I won't remember the name of it. I'm so bad at names. She just did a production this past spring with the Wooster Group.
In New York.
It was something about the North Atlantic. I think it might have been called North Atlantic. It's about this. Ship that's off the coast of Ireland, and it was great. I went to see it because
she
was in it.
I love the Worcester Group, and they do such
and
great work.
Lucked into a night when the actors all came out and talked afterwards, was fascinating. So anyway, enormously intelligent. Again, I'm in great hands. I can just kind of sit back and be relaxed because I have the good luck to be connected to such smart, good people who are going to do right by my material.
Well, I said to you. Years back, when your first novel came out, when your first story came out, and it's been growing ever since. You've been growing as a writer. That when you get to be an old crone,
working on it.
You're not there yet, but you get to be an old crone. You'll be like an Agatha Christie. Your stuff is just it just keeps growing and growing. So,
I'd like to stay in print. I mean, I think that's one of the things that all writers.
Even if TV took off, you'd want to stay in print.
Oh, gosh, yes. And no one knows what's going on. It's been interesting with I'd Know You Anywhere. It made, I don't want to say it made history. That's a little bit overstating it. But it had an unusual experience within my own publishing company. They put a press release out last week. In its first week on sale, it did well enough to make the New York Times bestseller list. So that's great. It's going to be at number 16 on the list.
Wow, congratulations.
Right. Then that's hardcover copies.
Yeah.
It sold more digital copies. More.
Digital means it was the audiobook.
Like the Kindles.
Oh, the Kindles. I'm
e-book.
A little behind here. Okay, I'm sorry.
Digital copies. And HarperCollins put out a press release saying they had never seen another, what they would call sort of prominent title, one of their leading titles that's never happened before. And the view was that it was review driven. The book got very good reviews its first week out. And they think now the person who's motivated by reviews is also more likely to be a user of the Kindle or the Nook or the iPad.
Right.
And that makes instant gratification so easy. You know, really,
it's ridiculous.
Really talking like three buttons and you've got the book. So if you're sitting there and you're reading one of these reviews. And I'm not bragging about myself. I'm sort of still
in shock.
In shock. I've gotten good reviews. I've never gotten reviews like I've gotten with this book. I mean, we just keep waiting. I keep waiting for the bad fairy to show up at the christening because it's been just, you know, it's just been, oh, and here comes this person. It's just been down the line, really strong reviews. And, you know, again, the first week on sale, the digital copies outsold the hardcover copies.
It's a very interesting phenomenon.
That's a little postcard from our future.
You know, because when I was on the beach over the weekend, every time I looked around, somebody else was, I was reading this. This is a book.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else, there were Kindles all over.
I go both ways.
I haven't used one yet.
The Kindle is incredibly convenient. If you travel, it's hard to quarrel with the mobility it gives you. You know, the amount of books you can carry when you travel. I mean, a couple years ago, I went on an African safari where I was limited to 22 pounds. And when I went to the airport, and I had like maybe 3 days, though, before the weight thing kicked in, I was like a junkie going into rehab. And you know how they let you do heroin in the van one last time? I was just buying books at every place I could and inhaling them. I read like 7 books, and then I would like have to leave them somewhere before I went off on the safari because I could only have 22 pounds of luggage. And then as soon as I got off safari, I'm like back in the airport bookstore like, you know, I need this, I need this, I need this. And so if I had a Kindle, it was really sad. It was really sad. If I had had a Kindle, that would have, of course, solved everything. I'm okay with I feel a little defensive because there are all these people who say, oh, you people who say you love books, you're just so crazy. And if you like the way books smell so much, go wear book perfume. I like books. I like the way they feel in my hand. But to me, the most important aspect, and some future readers may change this, is that I don't like reading everything in the same font. And when I read my Kindle, everything is in the same font. And there's a certain chicken or the egg problem, which is everything seems a little flatter and only truly great voices kind of rise above it. But then again, I tend to use the Kindle more for B-reads. So maybe the reason more books aren't transcending the Kindle, as it were, is because I'm not buying the best books. But I will say I read the latest Anthony Bourdain on mm-hmm. the Kindle.
Mm-hmm.
And his voice came through strong and clear. There's no muzzling that voice. And I read 2 novels on the Kindle that I believe retained all of their power. And that was Dark Places by Gillian Flynn, who's one of my favorite up-and-coming young crime novelists. And Blame, a beautiful novel by a woman whose last name I cannot pronounce.
Blame.
Michelle, it's Huvenen. And it's an amazing book about this alcoholic English teacher in Pasadena, California, who kills someone and goes to prison for the accident and what happens to her life when she comes back out and now she's sober. And it's just a remarkably beautiful book.
Blame.
I'm a crime novelist, very deliberately, so I don't feel like I need to leave the genre to write great books. I just feel like I need to be a better writer and that it's all in me, that the genre doesn't hold me back. Blame, to me, is an example of what a literary novelist can do with what might have been just sort of a bare-bones crime story in a lesser writer's hands. It's just this beautiful, beautiful novel about liability and responsibility and the lives we lead is the consequence of, you know, mistakes we've made.
Laura Lippman, it's been wonderful to see you. Thank you so much
it's
for dropping by.
It's always great talking to you.
It's been great. I'd Know You Anywhere is a book not to miss. Laura Lippman, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gay Pinder, and Felicia Faison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.